microphone checker, microphone checker, microphone checker, microphone checker, microphone checker, microphone checker.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Worthless Knowledge Podcast. My name's Johnny Goodtimes.
I'm Nat the Truth Jones.
And we are thrilled to have such a symbiotic situation. I think that's the right word. To come together like this so beautifully. I had a quizzo question a couple weeks ago about this famous 1936 propaganda film, and the title of the film was Reefer Madness. So we have decided to bring on as our special guest the one and only Reef the Lost Car. Reef, were you named after this movie?
In fact, I was. My mother saw it in 1938. A few years after, before I was born in the 40s. And she loved it so much. She just was like, I can't not name my son after this propaganda film.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's so good to have an old head like you on the show. You know, a guy that comes from that 1930s, 1940s generation.
Sure. I've seen it all, man.
Yeah. Of course you have. And one thing you've seen very recently is the film Reefer Madness.
Mm-hmm.
As we all watched this film for the first time in our lives in the past 24 hours. And just want to send it out to both of you, just sort of initial thoughts upon seeing the 1936 propaganda classic Reefer Madness.
It struck a lot of chords for me, Johnny. So I smoked weed once, and I got to say, this was dead on. Yeah. This was exactly how it was for me.
It took me back to my days as a pot dealer that, you know, wore a suit and talked like Jimmy Cagney. I definitely remember, you know, the days that I would go to the speakeasy and give orders and, you know what I mean? Just make sure all the kids were getting high on my watch, you know?
So all the kids who were wearing suits and ties. Yeah. It was confusing. It was a little bit unsettling for me. They kept calling them kids, but these were like, you know, clearly people in their mid 20s that were
not early 30s,
dressed to the nines.
Yeah. Well, before old Ralph gets the attempted kill, Jack's calling him. He's like, settle down, kid. I just want to talk to you, kid. And it's like, Ralph's like 50, man.
Although they do say at the beginning of the film, one of them says to the other one, my dad says Ralph's a little too old for us. Remember that? You remember? And I remember, I think Bill's response to that was, like, I think that's actually what he said. Bill was the most trusting guy.
Yeah.
He's a real tragic figure here.
He is.
And Mary, don't get me started on how tragic Mary is.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Being shot and killed in a scuffle, in a marijuana fueled scuffle, right, when you're an innocent bystander, I mean, it doesn't get more tragic than that. I want to start with the start of the film, and it starts with a piece of paper that the camera is slowly rolling down on. And it says the following: the motion picture you are about to watch may startle you. It would not have been possible otherwise to sufficiently emphasize the frightful toll of the new drug menace which is destroying the youth of America. Its effect is sudden, violent, uncontrollable laughter. Then come dangerous hallucinations. Space expands. Time slows down, almost stands still. Now, I almost feel like that's more of a commercial for marijuana than warning against marijuana.
If I saw that, I'd be like, that sounds fucking awesome.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this sad truth is weed, and I mean, weed's great. It's nowhere near that good.
No.
Even the really good stuff. That reminds me a lot more of like nitrous.
Yeah, There you go.
Yeah.
Get some wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah going on.
Can I comment on the words that the camera was panning down on, Johnny?
Sure.
So first thing is, very reminiscent to how we used to open our movies in like 1990 with a video camera. We would have some narration on a sheet of notebook paper and we would slowly move the camera up or down it. So pretty similar effects. Mm-hmm. Second of all, were you struck by how long the opening crawl was? I kept expecting it to be over and then they'd tack on another seven paragraphs.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine? It was like the Star Wars crawl, but much worse.
Yeah, and I felt like the film starts slow.
It doesn't really pick up, man, to that, like, that last 15 minutes. It was just like, aside from the poor old man getting run over, there was not much happening. Like, you know what I mean? Like, time and the showdowns, you know?
You're totally right, Reef. But I will say, to the film's credit, the last 15 minutes are like the last 15 minutes of Last of the Mohicans. I mean, it's like, you are glued to your seat. You're clutching the arms of the couch or the chair. Like, if you got to go to the bathroom, you're holding it in.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a slow burn. It's a slow burn. Trust us, folks. The payoff is there. Yeah. The payoff, you just got to wait for. And you know, because the thing is, part of it is because you fall in love with these characters. You know, you just, each one's got their own unique personality and just see the ravages of marijuana on no matter what, you know, no matter what their background is, whether it's a 23-year-old white man in a suit or a 22-year-old white man in a suit,
I think that that's the thing that this film doesn't get enough credit for. It's just the diversity of it all, you know?
Right. True. You have white men of all different ages within a 5-year range. And then a couple white women that would probably fall into that sweet spot as well.
Threw some dames in there.
You even had a little kid. Remember the kid? What a heat check from him, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, I love that cameo.
He came in off the bench and was just like, he was bebopping and scatting all over Bill.
Like we've said, it doesn't pick up till the end, but his appearance, that kid's appearance, brought a little jolt of energy.
A little youthful energy.
The film desperately needed it.
And also it plants some important information, makes you really feel for Bill, because after all the shenanigans and back and forth, the kid does say to him, like, something like he had something broken, and he goes, I'll bet you can fix it, Bill. You can fix anything. So Bill, a very competent guy.
Right.
But I can tell you this. Once he started smoking weed, he wasn't fixing much.
Nope.
No, that's what went right out the window.
All went downhill.
So the film was financed by a church group in 1937. And I'd love to have been in that meeting where they said, you know, we've got a little extra cash on hand, guys. What should we do? And they say, how about we make a film talking about the dangers of deadly marijuana?
And was in that meeting like, oh, let's feed the poor. And someone's like, sit down, like, Mary. Nobody wants to do that. We got to scare some people into not smoking weed.
Yeah. We're not spending this money on food for the poor. What is this, the Great Depression? Oh, no, wait, it is.
Oh, right. We're actually right in the thick of that.
Right.
But screw it. We're still doing the damn movie.
If you had a time machine and you could go back, say, witness 5 events in human history, would this have been in the top 5?
Being a part of the church group meeting that decided.
Yeah, let's say you're not even going as an observer. You can actually interact. You can put on like the suit and get in there and you've got a vote. Let's say there's like 8 or 9 votes on the board. Let's say you have one of them. Right.
Yeah. I think that'd be like around 4. I think Moonwalk would probably be number 1.
You mean like on the moon or the Michael Jackson moonwalk?
No, Michael Jackson's number 3.
Oh, yeah, that's 3. Yeah, right. That moonwalk. Yeah, the top 5 is definitely both moonwalks.
Right. That's going to be 40% of your top 5. That's a given. Let's say you actually believed that marijuana did the things that this movie says it does. Like, how big a priority would it be in that case to try to stop it? Bill Harper, Mary, Jimmy, Ralph. Ralph was always kind of a nut.
Yeah, Ralph. That just accentuated who Ralph already was. You know, it just brought it all out of him.
Right. It's like taking the super soldier serum in Marvel. Like, it just made Steve Rogers like this great guy, but it turned Red Skull into this Nazi overlord. That's the best comparison I can think of.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Stop what you're doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. I look...
So this is within context of what really was Reefer Madness, which is the 1930s. Mm. And this guy, Harry Anslinger, who was America's drug czar of the 1930s. Mm. And he was the source behind this whole paranoia that had gripped the country. And it kind of, Reefer Madness, while it wasn't made by the government, it fit in real nicely with what was already going on, which was that people were getting all of this insane propaganda from newspapers, and this just reinforced it. So Reefer Madness was just seen as, oh, I read about this in the news. Oh, it's really happening. This film says it's based on true events. Those true events are like things that Harry Anslinger was putting into the media, which were insane. Like, you know, the guy would axe murder his family and they'd be like, oh, he's a pothead. And like, of course, the medical community was like, no, he was a paranoid schizophrenic.
Right.
Like the pot had no influence on this murder. But, you know, that's the way they put it in the papers. So it's tying into this whole era of pot prohibition. And the film came out basically at the same year as the Marijuana Tax Act.
Was this film in, like, was this in theaters? I mean, I guess that's the only place you could watch movies like this.
Right. There was no straight to video.
Yeah. I'm just imagining people like on a Sunday, like, oh, let's go see Reefer Madness. And, you know, they get their popcorn and for a nickel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go see the moving pictures.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So the thing that's I'm not quite sure about the timing of, but like they make the movie. I don't know where the hell a church group show in the movie. Now, maybe they have a theater inside their church. I mean, obviously, they're swimming in money. Like right. The people that are in the movie, like a couple of them were like actually like B actors that appeared in some Hollywood films. Like some of them, really? like some of them are just like guys off the street, but some of them were actually some actors. So I mean, to get a film made, it's not like, you know, you flipped your iPhone and like, you know, put up the green screen. Like back then that had to be a ton of money. Like that had to be.
So I can tell you how much money it was. I looked it up.
Wow.
It's $100,000 budget.
Wow.
Which today translates to like 1.7 or 8 million. So what I wanted to ask you is, how do you think they broke down that budget? Where do you think the money went? So, I mean, you probably had, I guess most of it was paying the actors. One of the things I was struck by watching the movie was how terrible the sound editing was.
Oh my God.
I mean, it was just awful. Yeah. Like there were times that like someone's mouth literally wasn't moving, but there was just dialogue going on in the background. So I'm going to say like they didn't spend as much on sound editing as they probably should have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Editing in general, like everything moved, like someone would speak and then the person would just stare at them for like 30 seconds and be like, yeah, that's right. You know what I mean?
That's the ticket.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, okay, guys, we can cut the first 28 seconds of that stare and get it right back into the flow of a conversation.
No, but the 68-minute running time was really important to him.
Right, right.
Well, that's how you knew it was a real film. You know, this wasn't...
We're spending $100,000, $1,936 on this. We're going to make sure it's a little over an hour.
In the midst of the Great Depression. We're spending millions. I mean, this must have been like Joel Osteen's church. Like, this must have just been like the biggest church on earth. They're like, oh, we got money for films.
I will say that car was really nice. The car that they killed the man in. That was a nice car. So that's a couple thousand right there, you know?
Right. That was another poor edit, I thought.
I was going to say the same thing, man. Was not the most believable hit and run I've ever seen in my life.
The guy, like, turns the right. The man's there. The next clip, the man's gone.
Right.
But there doesn't seem to have been any impact on the car. Like, it doesn't slow down. You know, then the next thing you know, the man's just lying in the street and, you know, they're riding off in their suite, person who watched the colorized version, the car was yellow.
That scene actually led to one of my favorite scenes in the movie, which is when the police come and question the woman at the door.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple cool things from that scene. First of all, they just, even though she's clearly acting in a very suspicious way.
Right.
When they're asking her these questions, they just completely take her word for everything. They don't get any corroboration from anybody. They're just like, all right, well, what she's saying is unequivocally true.
Right.
That was my first thing that I wanted to point out. The second thing was when she asked, oh my gosh, like, did the man die? And the cop goes, no, thankfully he didn't. And then he just quickly goes, but that's no excuse. For like running a man down, you know, the fact that he was just in critical condition absolved the driver of the car of any wrongdoing. He wanted to let her know, like,
still
not off the hook.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hit and Run's still wrong.
It's still bad.
It's still no joke.
He didn't die.
Right.
But I'll tell you what, don't.
But then he did die. He
did. So this guy named Dwayne Esper, who's an exploitation film producer and distributor, was able to buy the film. He recut the film and added a few racy scenes. So you remember early in the movie when like that woman's showing a lot of leg? Holy cow, this is 1930s? Like, oh, I didn't know they could do this. Like, that's what he did. He came in, he added a couple of racy scenes because he saw like, oh, people want to see a movie about other people smoking pot with like hot legs. He had produced and directed such films as Sex Madness, How to Take a Bath, Sinister Harvest, and How to Undress in Front of Your Husband.
Wow, this guy sounds fun.
Were these like legit instructional videos? Like how to take a bath? Was he like taking, walking you through the steps?
No, I think it was kind of brilliant marketing is what it was. I think when I hear how to take a bath, I'm like, well, starring who?
Right, like, right.
See, I don't. When I hear that, I think to myself, like, have I been doing it wrong?
Right. Is there another way we haven't been taught yet?
I definitely am going to spend a nickel and watch this. What if I've been doing it wrong?
So what was the first one you said? Is Sexual Madness? So he loves to put
Sex Madness. Okay. Sex Madness.
Right.
Yeah, How to Take a Bath. I think, that's definitely the kind of thing that if I'm driving by the old theater and I see How to Take a Bath up on the, up on the marquee, it's going to get my mind run.
I'm pulling over.
Yeah, I want to see what the poster looks like. Sinister Harvest, which, I feel like that could be like a great album. I feel like that could be a great punk rock band.
That sounds
a great movie title.
Sinister Harvest would be a great punk rock band. And then How to Undress in Front of Your Husband. So I think, he's kind of, he's doing a good job with titles to get people's, because here we are, we're over 80 years later, and I think we're all a little bit intrigued by a film called Sinister Harvest or a film called How to Undress in Front of Your Husband.
Sure,
like this man had a marketing genius.
Sure. Well, we're dirtbags, so,
Well, that's true too, and that's a fair point. But I think
I'm pretty. It's funny because the clientele that these church-going board members were going for was probably like just good, decent people. Right. But in fact, they have probably did attract a pretty substantial dirtbag contingent, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the genius of Dwayne Esper. Dwayne saw this. Dwayne Esper saw the potential in this film to attract dirtbags. Cause like the church group, probably nobody even cared. They're like, this is like so stupid. This is boring. But then Dwayne Esper kind of turned it into hey, do you want to see hot babes smoking pot?
Right,
and then the answer is always going to be yes. That's as universally true now as it was then. Esper's genius was in seeing this boring church film and saying, let's sex this up a bit and turn it into a rock hit.
And then the Esper cut was born.
Yeah.
Have you seen Reefer Madness? Yeah, I was like, have you seen the Esper cut? It
changes the whole vibe of the film, man. You got to see the Esper cut.
Yeah, you do. Now in color.
Now in color. Oh man.
Yo, I'm making money, see. So yo world, I hope you're ready for me. Now gather round. I'm the new fool in town, and my sound's laid down by the underground. I'm drinking a ball of Hennessy you got on your shelf. So just let me introduce myself. My name is Humpty.
The exploitation films were big back in the 30s, and it was kind of the things where they would show them, I guess, at like smaller theaters, like not big movie theaters. You would go to like your small neighborhood theater, the Nickelodeon, and they would have films about, they were like almost like snuff films. It was like the films had like racy dances in them where the women were very, barely clothed. They would have venereal disease. They'd go to the venereal disease ward of a local hospital. They might show like a baby being born, which back then was just absolutely scandalous.
Yeah.
And Esper, our boy Dwayne Esper, is considered by some to be the father of exploitation films. And one of his stunts was to display the mummified corpse of Oklahoma outlaw Elmer McCurdy in the theater lobby before his shows.
This guy sounds awesome, man.
We're not getting quite the business that I had hoped we would on some of these films I've made. But you know what would drum up a little more business? You ever heard of Elmer McCurdy? extremely minor Oklahoma bandit from like 60 years ago.
Because I got his corpse, just, you know.
Right. Don't ask me how. I have his mummified corpse in the back of my truck right now. It's in the parking lot. I could bring him in here, prop him up right now. Okay, don't ask me how I got it.
Yeah.
You don't want to know, trust me. But I got it. It's him. Oh, my That's God. Elmer.
Asper. Your request is
better. What percent increase in revenue do you think that brought in?
Oh, easily 10 to 20, yeah.
I was going to say 10% yeah. at least.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, at least. I mean, here's the thing. Let me be perfectly frank with you guys.
Please.
If I'm on the fence about going to the theater to see a film,
sure.
I'm like, well, you know, I'm a little bit tired. I don't know if I really want to go. If I then find out subsequently that Elmer McCurdy's corpse is going to be in the lobby, that's going to be the tipping point for
me. Yeah.
That's me saying, you know what? I am going to see that movie.
How can you not go after you find out that? You know what I mean?
All right, because then someday you got to explain it to your kids. You know, like someday the kids are going to be like, oh, Dad, did you go to the theater that time Elmer McCurdy's corpse was in there? What are you going to say, no?
Nope.
They're going to be like, what's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? Jimmy's dad went. Jimmy's dad's way cooler than you.
Yeah, Jimmy's dad's the coolest. He saw that corpse.
They saw him in three different cities. They're like, let's go see him again.
They went on tour.
Maybe he's wearing a different outfit this time.
They were selling omelets out in the parking lot.
Yeah, they were traveling state to state with the tour.
Yeah,
I saw him in Philly. I saw him in Camden. I'm thinking of going up to New York City and seeing his mummified remains. Don't you want to know a lot more about Elmer McCurdy now?
Oh, yeah. I think...
If you think I'm not doing the Wikipedia dive as soon as we get off the air.
It sounds like you guys got your next episode already ruminating. Whoa.
So,
Jesus, man.
Oh, God. I just
want, like, people, I mean, people are still weird, but back in the day, man, people were just fucking bizarre. Like, the stuff they would do, it's like, why would you do that at all, you know?
Well, right, because you didn't have TV. So you weren't just, you know, what are you going to do? Sit around the house?
right.
You had to go see the corpse. If a corpse came to town, you're going to see it. What the hell else are you going to do?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, what are we going to do tonight? Am I going to stare at this wall or am I going to go see Elmer McCurdy's dead body? That's a no-brainer.
And poke it with a stick.
Right. So Esper goes on to direct a film called Sex Maniac, in which a vaudeville impersonator named Maxwell becomes an assistant to a mad scientist named Dr. Meerschaltz, and it is considered by many to be the worst film ever made.
That's interesting, because in the Wikipedia entry for Reefer Madness, it says specifically it's widely considered one of, if not the worst movies ever made.
Right. And I think that's what's fascinating to me about our boy Dwayne is that...
It's kind of his lane.
It's his lane, yeah. He just makes really terrible movies.
Right. He knows how to make a cheap, terrible movie, but he also knows how to get you into the theater to watch it.
Right.
That's the brilliance. Like, everybody wants to talk about the crap he churned out. Nobody wants to talk about the brilliance that you still came to see it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And so, but here's Gizmodo did a write-up about Sex Maniac. Maxwell decides to disguise himself as Dr. Meerschaltz and make some statement about trying to revive the dead mad scientist at some point. But he's mostly too busy injecting crazy people with water and scooping out cat's eyes. And then the film cuts for long stretches to scenes of women standing around in their underwear and having long conversations while doing the Charleston and pressing their clothes.
Scooping out cat eyes?
Yep.
Oh, Lord.
It's so rare that you hear a synopsis that includes injecting water and crazy people, scooping out cat's eyes, and the Charleston.
Right. It's a very...
It's usually a different movie.
Right, or a different dance move thrown in there. You know what I mean?
So, getting back to our film of record, Reefer Madness, for those of you just joining us, and there's no reason you would be just joining us.
What if somebody downloaded the podcast, you know, is a small group. And then was like, I'm going to cut 38 minutes in.
Yeah, let me get to the good stuff.
See what they're talking about.
So I want to run through a little bit, run through the film and sort of the plot and kind of pick apart that a little bit. I know we've been through some of it, but it was May and Jack are basically the big time drug hustlers of the neighborhood. They live in a
clearly sleeping with each other, but not married. You can tell they're bad people based on that.
Yeah. So they were living in sin. I mean,
living in sin. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so Bill, who, as we mentioned earlier, was very handy, but whose pristine record at school has rapidly declined, has a fling with Blanche while high. So then Mary, who, by the way, played by Dorothy Short, who is from Philadelphia. So shout out to Dorothy.
Shout out to Philadelphia.
Yeah. goes to May's apartment looking for Jimmy and accepts a joint from Ralph, thinking it's a regular cigarette. When Ralph, she refuses Ralph's advances, he tries to rape her. Bill comes out, and there's a fight. And in the fight, now naturally, this guy is a pot dealer, so he's got a gun on him.
Right, you know, he's ready to go.
Yeah, that's how pot dealers have always been. And so they start fighting with that. They shoot Mary, played by Dorothy Short, in the back, and she falls upon the couch dead.
Remarkably small amount of blood, by the way.
Yeah. Like almost like a droplet.
She did not die from loss of blood, that's for sure, because it all stayed inside her.
I thought she might have not even been dead, but then old boy went over to her, started shaking the life out of her, saying, please talk to me, wake up. And I'm like, I don't think that's helping, man. You know what I mean? You might be making it worse.
I liked how Jack, the pot dealer, the one with the gun and the suit and all that, I like how Jack pronounced her dead.
Yeah, yeah.
In, she's gone. You know, 30 seconds. He was just kind of looks at her and just looks up. She's dead. First of all, not that shook up by it, but also just very confidently with that white male confidence of the 30s, just very confidently proclaiming this woman dead and everyone just being like, yeah,
he's probably right. Yeah. Well, Jack, right. Jack would know.
No
Jack
point. Jack would know. Jack would know.
Jack's like 2 years older than us. He knows he's an older boy. He's an older boy. Yo. It's like, why didn't you know she was dead? An older boy told me she was. So.
Oh, young Jack.
Jack, the thing about that you have to appreciate about Jack, and I think this is once again true of all pot dealers, is that even after there's a murdered body on the couch, he's acting calmly and rationally. He's not acting out of emotional, you know, he's thinking to himself, how am I going to get myself out of this situation? I'm going to frame Bill.
Right.
So Bill's lying unconscious on the floor. Jack puts the gun in Bill's hand.
It's also props to Jack for doing something we've seen in movies for the next 100 years, which is wiping the gun off, wiping his fingerprints off. Very smooth.
It's not his first rodeo.
Right. Yeah.
And like Johnny said, he's remarkably calm. He's like a regular, like a Sully Sullenberger here. You know, he's just like, well, here we go. Well, I've been waiting my whole life to deal with a situation like this. And he just calm and collected. He could have easily freaked out.
Right, right.
And then things could have gone differently. He didn't.
Nope.
Like, he didn't need to really plant the gun. He just, if he was the first one with the story, I mean, back then they had no way to know, you know, like there was no, like, you know, video evidence or anything. Like, you just had to get there first.
Sure.
You just had to be the first one in the cop station saying the other guy shot her, and that guy's done. Like, you're out of trouble.
It's like they just completely took that woman's word for it at the door. It's like you said, it's whoever's fastest, whoever can run to the police station fastest is not going to prison.
Yep.
It was a good system.
So now we get to probably sure. Why does anybody want to change it? Anyway. Right. So
prison would just be filled with all these really slow people.
Right. Yeah.
Please allow me to bump me. I'm stepping tall, y'all. And just like Humpty Dumpty, you're gonna fall when the stereos pump me.
So Ralph is now getting paranoid, and this leads to maybe the most memorable scene of the film, which is hard to believe after what we just described, but this one's right now we're in the heat of the action. Okay, again, we kind of skipped through the slow stuff, folks. We're getting right to the meat and potatoes here. And Blanche and Ralph are getting high. She starts playing the piano. And Ralph, who is slowly losing his mind, keeps encouraging her to play faster and faster. and it, like in a deranged,
just like anybody who was really high.
Yeah, play the piano.
You just want everything. Speed up. Let's go. Come on. Come on. Double time. Double time. Let's go.
I personally, like, when I get stoned, I'd make my kids, you know, run around in circles as fast as they can. It's very,
I'm like, jumping jacks. More. Push ups.
Higher energy.
It's true. The way he's acting is—it's
the opposite of weed.
An odd way for someone.
It makes me think no one on the weed. Anyone involved in the movie actually never had weed because they're doing everything opposite.
Or they had had it. They had had it, but they didn't want the others to know that they had had it because it's deadly marijuana.
Right.
So
right.
They just went along with it. And they just kept saying, "Oh no, that's what really happens. Yeah, you turn it." Speed freak.
Yeah, you want people to play the piano really fast around you. It's crazy.
Yeah,
and apparently it never wears off.
Yeah, never.
Right. And she's really wailing. Like, she abides by his request. I mean, she's
talented.
Yeah. She can play those beats. I mean, she's like, oh, faster. Okay, watch this. I was like, okay. I was kind of admiring her playing while at the same time seeing this man slowly lose his grip on reality. Then there's sort of one of those boring office scenes where Jack tells the boss tells Jack to shoot Ralph.
Right.
So Jack.
Can we pause for a second? Because the boss, I think, is a very underrated character in this film. He's only in like two scenes, but he's the most, like, he's like an accountant, but also like a drug lord. Like, he's like sitting there like doing math numbers, and another guy comes in the room and is like, I want to retire, boss. He's like, yeah, you know what happens when you want to retire? It just, I love that guy.
Oh, he said to him, he goes, hey, you can retire permanently, I believe is what he said.
Yeah.
Which is a huge flex. I don't remember exactly how it went. It's a long, long time ago. Sure. I'm sure there was supporting actor buzz around the boss,
the boss in 1936. Great. That guy was awesome. Shout out to that guy.
Sure, his name was at least kicked around a little bit in the conversation.
A little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the boss, the boss is ruthless, but he's also exceptionally well-organized. I mean, he's kind of like, what's his name in The Wire?
Stringer Bell. He's the new Stringer Bell.
Yeah, he's like Stringer Bell. He's like the Stringer Bell character. He's ruthless, but he's also very calm, and he does all the finances, very well organized.
He's got lists. This is who I gave drugs to today, their name and how much they owe him. You know what I mean? Right. He's got it all down.
Yeah, no, he was the film Stringer Bell, absolutely. And again, Reef, I know you even mentioned this the other day on Twitter, and that wasn't even what triggered me saying it, but you said...
I was going to say, did he reference the boss from Reefer Madness and how much like Stringer Bell he is?
No, but no, you I were just saying talked about you bring any just, conversation back to The Wire.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys, yeah. Yeah, just you could be talking about, oh man, this movie's great, this show's great. I'm like, yeah, that's crazy, man. You ever seen The Wire?
Right. Let's get back to my favorite show.
Yeah. So, yeah, great comparison. I agree with Nat. Like, Stringer Bell is definitely this guy's, you know, this is who Stringer Bell was modeled after, clearly.
Right. Obvious. I think it goes without saying.
I'll bet Idris Elba watched this movie like
he studied
a ton of times. He's like his mannerisms, how he deals with people,
his outfits, his voice,
the whole nine.
So Jack arrives, he's like a tough, and he arrives and Ralph realizes what's happening. Because Ralph, again, I mean, Ralph is always, you know, one step ahead of the game. Ralph sees what's happening. He grabs a stick and he just begins beating Jack just ruthlessly. I mean,
yeah, what was that stick, by the way?
Yeah, that stick wasn't, yeah.
Because it kind of looked like a pool cue, right. But there was no pool table.
Yeah.
He just had it ready. He knew what was coming. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to get a fucking big stick. And when this dude comes in, I'm going to be ready for him.
It's the type of stick that you would bring to the movie theater to poke the mummified corpse of Elman McCourty with. Similar brand of stick.
Yeah.
They were more common than you think in the mid-30s. Just sticks like that. Everyone had a stick like
poking
that.
Poking around. This is a real cord. This really is cord.
You got to have a poking stick on you. And if you're like really high, that poking stick can become a beating stick real fast.
That's, you know, that's one of those things that's lost through time. Back in the 30s, everybody had a poke and stick.
Everybody had a poke and stick for poking around.
Yeah, you poke around.
Oh, man, we should bring poke and sticks back.
Yeah, you couldn't, you know, because that's the thing. You didn't have the internet. You couldn't do research before you got there. Right. You had to get there and poke around a bit.
Yeah. What's going on here? Yeah. What's that under there?
Everyone had a poke and stick in the mid-30s. And Johnny's like, well, you got to remember, they didn't have the internet.
You know, where were they going to find
out? Of course they had poke and sticks.
Oh, man.
Think like the really up... rich people, maybe like their poke and stick, like they had a case for it. Yeah.
Gold tips. It was like a gold tip at the bottom.
Yeah, like it was made out of the finest wood in all the land. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And carved.
Yeah, like coal wood. Yeah, oh, wow. Look at old Mr. Sullivan's poke and stick. Holy cow, that thing's got to be worth a fortune.
Oh, Mr. Sullivan, I'll bet he's poked a few bodies in his day with that thing.
Yeah. It's you know it's his because it has the Sullivan family crest on it. You know what I mean?
It's like in gold. The family crest is gold on the handle.
Been in his family for four generations.
This poking stick belonged to my pappy and his pappy.
Right. He poked bodies in the Revolutionary War with this thing. Just,
yeah. So this is really where the film, I mean, this is where really right now we're just in the real heart of it. Just things are starting to slide out of control. Like at this point, you're still hoping that things are going to go back to like their normal, dull suburban existence, but it's just not happening. The drugs are kicking in heavy. There's guns, there's poking sticks. And at this point, Ralph just starts beating Jack. Just, mm-hmm. I mean, furiously. And the thing that really, I think, frightens us about the scene is that all of a sudden Blanche starts laughing uncontrollably as she's watching a man being beaten to death. Because when you're high on marijuana and you see someone beaten to death with a poke and stick, there's nothing funnier.
Yeah, it's just, it's the drug was designed to make you laugh at people being beat to death with poke and sticks. Like that's the first thing when I bought pot, my dealer was like, listen, man, if you see someone getting beat to death with a poking stick, it makes it that much better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's whenever.
Well, it tells you that in the opening crawl of the movie. They literally say that in like the first 30 seconds. That the first thing that happens is just uncontrollable laughter.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, if I was high, I mean, I guess it was depending on who was beating who with the poking stick, you know, sure. To determine, I mean, if I thought it was funny. But I feel like, you know, I feel like it's something I definitely don't want to see while I'm high. Right. I definitely don't want to see somebody just getting beaten savagely. Like that's not the time for that. But Blanche, I think probably part of it was probably nerves. Yeah. I'm guessing she had,
you think it was a nervous laugh?
Yeah, I think it was,
I don't really know what to do. It's kind of awkward. So I'm going to start laughing.
Yeah. And then it just, you know, and then because of the drugs kicking in, just kind of, it kind of, the laugh kicked into overdrive. And suddenly, you know, she was like, it seemed like she was deranged.
She ran when the cops came in.
Yes.
She ran into the room, which was not a great plan.
No, they caught her pretty quickly.
Yeah.
They also just opened the door and they were just like, cops. Like there was no kicking, no knocking. They just opened the door very calmly and ran in. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Blanche, you know, who so recently has been, been laughing hysterically while watching a man murdered, suddenly is having some second thoughts about the whole thing. She's starting to feel some guilt. She then explains that Bill was innocent. Bill didn't actually shoot Mary.
Right.
It was all a setup. So she lets the cops know that, but she, you know, I don't know if it's fear or if it's guilt, but she's walking down a hallway and suddenly takes off running and jumps out of a window to her death.
Yeah. Well, it was a combination of fear, guilt.
I hate to bring the mood down. You know, I hate, cause we all, you know, we all fell in love with Blanche over the course of this film and we saw the good in her, you know, even at a time, I don't know if she saw it herself.
By the way, cops 100% took her word for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again. They're just like, oh, that's what happened? Okay. And then, clearly she's like a sound mind. I mean, she literally threw herself out of a window 10 seconds after that, making that confession, but they were like, well, this is gospel.
Right. Yeah, right. Like she was laughing hysterically while a man was beaten to death, and then she jumps out of a window. But in between, she tells cops it was a setup, and the cops are like, well, that does it. It was a setup. That whole court case is all for naught.
Right. Yeah. And then my boy gets absolved of all crimes and hugs his family, and it's like, oh, this was a great day.
No, it's a feel-good. It's a feel-good. It really is.
It's like, Your Honor, I'd like to reference the testimony of a clearly insane, mentally impaired woman.
That jumped out of a window.
Right, that killed herself right after she gave it.
Is she here? No, she just jumped out a window a few minutes ago.
He's like, well, that is compelling. But that does lead us to the court scene at the end, which is just fantastic. So, first of all, what an efficient criminal justice system this is.
Yes.
I mean, there's no bullshit here at all.
Right.
They're just like, hey, we've got the testimony of this insane woman, so we're gonna let you off. But
yeah.
Don't think I'm letting you off scot-free. I'm going to make you stay and watch the next court case that's coming in here, right. Which he does, and watches Ralph get sentenced to a hospital for the criminally insane for the rest of his natural life.
Sure.
Like, they're not going to keep him alive with machines or anything like that, but the rest of his natural life, he's going to be put away. Yeah. And that all happened in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
In and out. Like, how many people do you think that judge sentenced to life that day? Like 70?
That guy was moving them. He was getting them in and out.
Also, Ralph's attorney's completely fine with that deal.
Yeah, yeah. They're just like, oh, we're not going to. Yeah, that's good. That's good. All right, Ralph. See
you
later.
The rest of his natural life, you say? That sounds fair. Sounds reasonable.
Yeah, right. I'm not going to argue against that. Oh, in a prison for the surrounded by completely insane people? Yeah.
For the criminally insane?
Sure.
For the rest of his natural life? Yeah,
we can do that.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't see why we'd say no. I don't see why we'd appeal something like that.
By the way, how much time had passed from the time that Ralph was arrested to the time that he was put away for the rest of his natural life, would you estimate?
30 minutes.
Because I'm pretty sure he was wearing the same clothes.
30 minutes to an hour. Like, they took him from the apartment. Took him from the apartment to right to the courthouse.
It's like, that was right. It. I mean, he still seemed high too.
Right.
I see. You know, I think this film is why a lot of people are mad at the justice system now, because they see how great it was back then.
Right. Right.
You know, they see a film like Reaper for Madness and they say, my God, this man killed a woman. This man killed another man. And before the body was cool, he had already been convicted to a life in a criminally insane prison. Like, wow. I mean,
the Constitution does give you the right to a speedy trial.
Right.
They were really in the 30s that, man, they just would wrap themselves in the Constitution.
They weren't kidding around. They were not messing around.
We want this quick, quick, before dinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sentenced for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, so like I said, kind of, I mean, at that point, Ralph is just, you know, completely in the throes of Reefer Madness. I mean, that's what we see. And then, you know, and then the narrator comes on at the end and it said, this could very easily happen to you or you or you.
And he's also like, this really did happen.
Points at you.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, this is based on real stuff.
Right. And that takes us back to Anslinger. I mean, that was Anslinger's whole thing, is like, he would make like any horrific murder situation like this, he would just say pot was involved. Like, it didn't matter if it was or not. It was just, that was the news story. Man high on pot murders 7 people.
But come on, man. At the end of the movie, when that school board guy or whatever was talking, like you said, and was like, it could happen to you or you or you. And then all of a sudden he breaks the fourth wall and points right at
you.
Us. Or you. Tell me that didn't send chills down your spine.
I had
the guy was talking right to you. I was just like, whoa. Man, holy shit.
I had to cut it off. I couldn't look. He's the way he just stares with the finger pointed. I was like, I can't do this. It's like he was looking through your soul, you know?
No, well, he was traveling through time. I mean, that guy's been dead for decades. And he's still talking to you and me and to Nat. And he's talking to all of us through the years.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a remarkable piece of filmmaking that really gets the audience feeling like they're a part of the movie.
Sure. Where do you think Bill is now? Is he, obviously he's probably dead by now, but how do you think the rest of his life turned out?
I think he learned his lesson.
I'm
Do you think he thought about Mary often?
Nah, he probably got a new girl in like a week.
Sometimes I get ridiculous. I'll eat up all your crackers and your licorice. Oh, yo, fat girl, come here, are you ticklish? Yeah, I called you fat. Look at me, I'm skinny. It never stopped me from getting busy. I'm a freak. I like the girls with the...
So my other question that I had for you guys was, did you watch propaganda movies in high school? Were there ever, like, this was, you know, obviously a do-gooder propaganda movie. Did you guys ever see anything like that? Because in my school, I want to say in like 9th or 10th grade, we saw something that had been made in the 70s, clearly, with like all the ruffled tuxedos and everything. And it was about drunk driving. Not that, you know, there's, I don't mean propaganda in a bad way. Obviously, you don't want kids drunk driving at the prom. But like, it was one of those films where the girl comes down the stairwell looking beautiful. And then the next thing you know, she's like, you hear a scream and shattered glass and she's covered in blood. Like, it's the same sort of like sense of reefer madness of, if you do this, you're it's going to turn out that the consequences will be tragic beyond your wildest dreams. Did you guys ever see anything like that?
I came up in the Dare program era.
I was in the first year of Dare.
Yeah, man.
When I was in sixth grade.
So there was all types of, you know, the scared straight type cop would come and tell you you're going to die, and there'd be all types of video. I mean, some of it was real, some of it was true, but obviously a lot of it was just meant to just scare the life out of you, you know?
I want to share a funny Dare memory.
Oh, yeah, let me hear it.
If I may indulge. So the first thing, I mean, in Dare, you probably remember, they actively encourage you to like turn in your parents, for instance, if they're like smoking weed. Like, they're just like, they're literally telling you, like, it's for the best. Like, it would be for the best if your parents were locked up and you were thrown into and you became a ward of the state. Yeah. That would help everybody. They're literally selling this. Yeah. So that's one thing. Right. The second thing is the cop that would come to our classroom. One of the recurring themes he would come back to is drug dealers. They do all this, you know, to make money, to have nice things, like, you know, fancy cars, nice clothes, stuff like that. And then he would bring it back to himself and he would be like, I'm not a drug dealer. I drive a nice car. And then this is my favorite thing that he would say. And he said this a couple times too. He goes, I drive a nice car. I wear Dockers. I'm not kidding. That he said that multiple times. He would remind us, like, he doesn't deal drugs. He does still wear Dockers though. You can have the finer. You can have the finer things in life without slinging smack.
Yeah, you can have Dockers.
He wore Dockers. Yeah. And so, and it was funny because I didn't know what Dockers were, and then I remember seeing like Dockers in a store like 2 years later, and just being like, "Oh, this is what this guy was talking about."
I'm gonna start dealing drugs. Fuck with this guy
right now. I mean, I don't want to end up wearing these things.
I wear Dockers.
All right, well, folks, want to thank our good friend Reef. Reef and I are two of the hosts of the Philly Blunt, so be sure to check that out. Reef also always putting out fantastic music. Reef, send out socials if you will.
At Lost Cause, cause spelled with a Z, because hip hop. And Reef the Lost Cause at bandcamp.com, Apple Music, all that goofy shit. And yeah, thank you guys for having me. This was awesome. I really needed this today. This was awesome. Good laughs. Yeah.
It was a blast. Thanks for coming on.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. We will see you next time. My name is Johnny Good Times.
I'm Nat the Truth Jones.
Take it light.
Later.